Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And I think I know why many of you are tuning in right now. And here's the answer, the best we can give it to you. We cannot say yet that Democrats have won control of the Senate, but we can say that's looking like the most likely outcome. The network decision desks, including Fox, I'll mention, have projected Raphael Warnock, the winner, over Kelly Loeffler. Democrat John Ossoff is leading in his race, but it's still too close to call. Here is Warnock in a victory statement referring to his mother.
The 82-year-old hands that used to pick somebody else's cotton went to the polls and picked her youngest son to be a United States senator. So I come before you tonight as a man who knows that the improbable journey that led me to this place in this historic moment in America could only happen here.
The now projected Senator-elect Raphael Warnock. Republican incumbent Kelly Loeffler, we should say, has not conceded, however, and says she still has a path to victory. If that's true, though, it's not much of a path. Warnock's lead is 53,000 votes. Now, Biden won the state by only 11,000, and that margin barely changed at all after two recounts, so 53,000 votes is relatively a lot in this context. Ossoff has now also claimed victory in his race, but the networks are not yet calling that one. His margin is smaller. According to a Fox News data analysis, and I'm citing Fox because their website does a good, clear data dive on this. It's the same data as everyone has, just a good analysis article. And according to the way they write it up, the Democrats were helped by strong showings among black voters, young voters, and suburban voters. One important stat, the share of voters in the runoffs who were black increased from 29% of all voters in November to 32% for the runoff, and they voted for Democrats by an 88-point margin in yesterday's election. That was 2 points more than the rate at which black voters went for Biden in November, which was an 86-point margin over Trump. So that's a lot of numbers, but in sum, black voters were a little more of the electorate this time, and they voted even a little more Democrat this time. That number, 32% of the electorate, is really interesting to me, by the way, because the stats as I know them are that black people in Georgia are 33% of the total population. So if they've now reached 32% or about the same of the electorate, voting in their actual percentage in the population is an incredible historic victory over voter suppression. Also, voters who described themselves as moderates went heavily for the Democrats. Moderates chose the Democrats in the runoffs by a 34 percentage point margin, according to that Fox analysis. And at the same time, Republicans Perdue and Loeffler won white voters by 46 and 44 percentage points, respectively, better than Trump's margin of victory among whites, which was 40%. But the share of white voters in the pool went down. In other words, in a polarized turnout election, it was even more polarized by race than the presidential, but more Democrats turned out. In some interesting results from the exit poll survey of voters, Georgia runoff voters had positive views of Biden, 51% favorable versus 47% unfavorable. Trump's marks were the reverse, 47% favorable, 51% unfavorable, according to Fox. So heads up, Republican candidates in elections to come, right? It looks like Trump's participation in these runoff races was a net negative for his party. Similarly, more people describe the Democratic runoff candidates as honest and trustworthy, 50% for Ossoff and 52% for Warnock, then said the same about Republicans. 46% said Perdue is trustworthy. 44% said Loeffler is, according to the Fox News exit poll, which, for the record, had a margin of error of 2.3 percentage points. So a small margin of error, those stats seem to be meaningful. And one more stat for now, comparing the two Democrats to each other at last report. This is so interesting. Warnock did just a little better than Ossoff, about 0.4 of a percentage point better. So Warnock got 50.6% of the vote. Ossoff, 50.2%. That's just enough of a difference to have the network data crunchers call the Warnock race, as they did, but not the one between Ossoff and Perdue, still counting. Warnock would be the first black senator from Georgia. Ossoff would be the state's first Jewish senator. And even as the counting goes on for who will be in the Senate, the Senate and House are beginning the process this morning of certifying the Electoral College vote in the presidential race. Even in apparent defeat, Kelly Loeffler says she will be among the senators who will object to the election results. It looks like they are in for many hours of floor debate today over about six swing states that some Republicans will object to, but they do not have the votes to successfully deny any results, even if the law allowed, which is very questionable. With me now, Washington Post national political correspondent Dave Weigel. Dave, thanks for joining us on a strange and historic morning. Welcome back to WNYC.
No, it's very good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Let's talk first about the Warnock-Loeffler race. What would you add or change from the data that I've been citing to explain the results as they stand right now?
I think that was a very good setup for what happened in the election. One way I was looking at it in the final days when I was in Georgia is that you basically had a version of the Trump campaign versus a version of the Biden campaign being run without Donald Trump on the ballot and with Donald Trump that are going to be discussed today trying to undermine the election result. So you had Republicans run a pure base campaign, and Kelly Loeffler was appointed this seat in part because she was a successful businesswoman, and there was an idea that she would offer a different face to the Republican Party to the suburban voters who've been trending the other way. She was in a primary, she ran hard to the right, and then she stayed pretty hard right in this runoff and ran a mostly negative campaign against Warnock, similar to what Donald Trump was doing against Joe Biden, down to how there wasn't one theme, really, about the dangers of electing Warnock. Now, she'd call him a radical liberal, that would appear in the ads, but every few days there was a new piece of opposition research and there'd be a new focus on that, to the point where the final weekend, when I was seeing her on the trail, she was talking about how he didn't get a donation from David Boies, who, among other people, has been a lawyer for Harvey Weinstein, but said that Harvey Weinstein's lawyer gave him money. That's not a coincidence. So she was kind of going after every character point she could, whereas Warnock, like Joe Biden and Ossoff, who I think we can maybe discuss separately, they just ran a very clear campaign saying we're nice guys, first of all. I mean, they did a lot of repackaging, rebranding, and very specifically, elect us, you're going to get COVID relief, you're going to get student debt relief, you're going to have health care expanded or protected, and then towards the end, and we're going to try to pass a $2,000 relief check for everybody. So like the presidential campaign, the Democratic message was fairly coherent, fairly positive, with negativity when they needed negativity, and the Republican campaign was much more base-centric. I mean, it's really not surprising to see the moderate numbers that you cited, because I can't think of a thing that the Republicans did to win moderates.
Really interesting. Listeners, your reactions to or questions about the Georgia runoff or the coming electoral vote floor debate in Congress today, 646-435-7280. For Dave Weigel from The Washington Post, 646-435-7280. Some of our Georgia listeners who've called in the past, anything you want to say to debrief these results or talk about what's still going on in the count or anything else? People in Georgia or anyone else anywhere else, 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280, or you can always tweet at Brian Lehrer. We'll keep our eye on Twitter. Before we change races and get to Ossoff Perdue, Dave, there are thousands of overseas and military ballots yet to be counted, some of which have not even been delivered yet by the post office. But I gather there are fewer of those than the margin of victory at this point, which is 53,000, which is why they can call the race. Is that your understanding?
That's exactly it. And that's a reason why the Ossoff race has not been called yet. But Democrats were anticipating this. You'll notice that Republicans held a victory party, or I guess there's an election night party last night with Senator Loeffler speaking. Democrats didn't have any events in person. I mean, they didn't even have a car rally because they were telling people this is going to be close. Our polling and our turnout model says it'll be close. We'll know by the end of the week who won. And that is how they operated. So in the Ossoff case, he benefits, I think, in terms of the perception of whether he's going to win from people having gone through this Biden recount experience. We now know that the Biden margin of 0.2%, it was a little bit less than 12,000 votes, seems very narrow, but that was barely changed at all by two recounts. And so when people look at numbers like Ossoff's getting, and the other expectation is that the final absentee ballots, the final ballots being counted from DeKalb County, maybe push him over 20,000 vote lead. We've seen that's just not a lead that gets obviated by recounts or by late votes. Now, technically, if the margin is within 0.5%, Senator Perdue can request a recount. I don't think there's much risk that he wouldn't. That could gum up things for a little while, but we kind of see the writing on the wall. That's not a margin that gets undone by a recount, but that is the reason why Warnock just has an unassailable lead and is going to be in the Senate without much of a question.
So if Warnock has an unassailable lead based on that data as you just described it, do you know on what basis Kelly Loeffler is refusing to concede and saying she has a path to victory?
Well, it's kind of a fashion right now to just not concede defeat if you are a supporter of the president. I mean, you've seen this in a number of races. There are House races, and to be fair, there are two House races that are still tied up in court or in a challenge where Democrats are behind, but trying to find the votes, not find them, trying to prove that there are votes that should be counted legally that put them at the top. So this isn't a Republican-only thing, but this level of denial where candidates are clearly mathematically eliminated and refuse to concede. Now, Loeffler has not talked about fraud in this race yet. I wouldn't rule it out. But I think it's more of that. Some of this is perception, too, if you think about it. Loeffler, who has not been elected to anything, is still a senator, and she's going to vote today to protest the Joe Biden victory in Georgia right after voters rejected her. So it's not a very good look, and I think maybe some projection that she is still maybe going to be a senator when this is over, that there's a path to victory. I think some of that is massaging the way this looks when she votes in a few hours, but no, some of it's just Republicans, if they don't have to concede just yet in this election, have just not been conceding, and the results get certified without them doing so.
And what's the latest you're seeing in the Ossoff-Perdue race? About an hour ago, Ossoff declared victory, but without the network data desks calling the race. Do you know on what basis he did that?
I was starting to describe some of it before, but this is very similar to what happened with Joe Biden, except Ossoff's in a slightly stronger position than Joe Biden was. You mentioned the overseas military ballots. It's important that they're overseas and military, because not only have Republicans done a bit worse, the president especially is a little bit less for the down-ballot Republicans, a little bit worse than they did 4 years ago with military voters. Overseas ballots, that's expats, that's diplomats. That's an electorate that was very strongly Democratic this year. And let's say there are 17,000 or so of those, let's say 15,000 of them were actually cast. Republicans would need to win, well, at this point, maybe 120% of those votes. But even 100% is unrealistic. And the rest of the votes that we're expecting, and if you kind of follow the Secretary of State's office in Georgia, which is under duress and kind of famously been providing regular updates on the race, they're telling everybody, here's what's still out. There's just votes in DeKalb County, which is part of the Atlanta, very liberal part of the Atlanta metro area. There's a little bit left in Savannah of absentee ballots. Really tens of thousands of ballots left. And if they break towards Ossoff, let's say even by 10, 15 points, that would probably put him over the runoff threshold. So this is why you're not here. You have heard the Perdue campaign say that they think they'll win when the votes are counted. they have not laid out a legal strategy. And look, because of the very litigious Trump campaign, we've seen what kind of arguments courts will put up with, what kind of votes they'll count and what kinds they don't. Yes. If Republicans were inclined to run this Trump playbook in Georgia again, they could, but we've seen it doesn't succeed when you have the President of the United States putting his weight on it. So why would it succeed now?
By the way, listeners, one pronunciation note. If you were seeing the election county by county maps on TV last night and hearing Dave just mention one of the key counties, DeKalb, and it looked to you like DeKalb, it's DeKalb Avenue in Brooklyn. It's DeKalb County in Georgia. It's Houston Street in Manhattan, and it's Houston County in Georgia. Yes, it is. And of course,
they got that one right.
They got that one right. And it's Houston, Texas. Curtis in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi, Curtis.
Hey, Brian. Good morning. It's a beautiful morning in New York. Who would have guessed that Georgia would turn everything around? What I'm struck by is that Joe Biden and Reverend Warnock basically ran on George H.W. Bush's kinder and gentler platform. Who would have known?
Well, that's interesting. What do you think about that historical analogy? Mm-hmm. After 8 years of Ronald Reagan, who was popular but divisive and seen as hardcore, his vice president, George H.W. Bush, ran for his election and won, of course, on moving to a kinder, gentler America. He's saying that's how Biden and Warnock won. What do you think about that historical analogy?
I think that ran through the entire Democratic campaign this year. That's true. I'd add something in Georgia, which is that any analysis of how Raphael Warnock won is going to have a lot of mention of what people probably call the puppy ads. So Warnock reintroduced himself once the runoff was called, once it started. He had the first in a series of ads where he warned that the negative ads were coming his way. Actually, I think the first line was, "Get ready, Georgia." And he warned that negative ads would say he hated puppies, among other things. So he stepped on a crack. Throughout the campaign, he was running these ads where he'd, you know, walk with puppies, have a dog in his lap when he was talking. There was this very specific effort to brand him as a relatable and kind pastor, because Democrats knew what was coming, which was this Republican campaign based on quotes from his sermons, protests he joined, civil disobedience he'd been involved in, that was going to portray him as in Leffler's words, a radical liberal. But it got more intense as it went on, a Marxist, anti-police, et cetera, et cetera. So there was a real effort to say, look, this is a guy who grew up in poverty in the projects, the 11th of 12 kids. A lot of campaigning, especially when you have hundreds of millions of dollars that you had in this race, a lot of that is about selling this package. And I think that was effective, obviously, in counteracting this Republican campaign. It also was a much better sales pitch than the one Loeffler in that race especially was using. This is somebody who was fairly unknown to political to voters in Georgia. You know, she's a very successful businesswoman, owner of the WNBA team. But the first thing people knew about her was this, that she might have made money off a stock trade after the coronavirus briefing. And she ran as this, blue jeans, Patagonia vest, cap with a Blue Lives Matter flag on it. She kind of rebranded herself as a Trump conservative, which to a lot of people struck as very phony. And I think a clip that's going to be played a lot, maybe by Democrats looking for Schadenfreude, that maybe for people explaining what's happening this week, is her walking up on stage with the president and saying, "I'm going to protest the Electoral College vote. We're going to get this done." Kind of doing air guns at the crowd, pointing at the crowd. That's one thing I found with voters. Even with Democratic voters who were organizing for Ossoff, they were really motivated not just by their like of Warnock, their like of John Ossoff, by Loeffler and what they would call her phoniness. And the final thing I'd say is, for Black voters, you mentioned how much the turnout increased Black voters. Warnock was benefiting from the fact that Black voters felt that the attacks on him were racist. They were trying to take rhetoric from the black church out of context to make it look dangerous and radical and violent. And at the same time, to white suburbanites, he was branding himself as, look, you really believe I'm a radical. Here I am. Here I am with this puppy. Here I am in the suburbs. Here I am with my sweater vest. It was a very successful effort to make him likable to voters because he also, I mean, the pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church is a figure in Georgia, but not one that, I mean, he started the race.
Right, and that's the position, for people who don't know this history, that's the position that Martin Luther King himself held.
Yes, and that's why I think it was resonant when black voters began to think, are Republicans attacking the black church? Are they attacking Martin Luther King's church for political gain? That was, I think, look at the vote outside of Atlanta, even, where it was expectedly huge for Democrats. Smaller cities with black majorities in kind of the rural black belt, turnout was increased massively from November for a runoff, because the old rule of politics in Georgia was if there was a runoff after a presidential election, black voters weren't motivated to turn out. I mean, Loeffler, I think by accident, created this turnout machine for black voters. And then Democrats did most of the work, I'm saying, but they had something to run on and something to run against.
We'll continue with Dave Weigel, national political correspondent for The Washington Post, in a minute. We'll talk about why Warnock seems to have done a little better than Ossoff. We'll talk about how the role of Trump in this race seems to set up Trump for better or for worse after he leaves office. We'll talk a little bit about what's going on in Congress right now, and we'll take more of your calls. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with the breaking news that Raphael Warnock has been declared the winner of that Senate runoff in Georgia. John Ossoff, the other Democrat, is leading in his race, but by a little bit less, just enough less that the networks haven't been able to call that one yet. So the counting is continuing in that. We're talking about that and the drama starting to take place in Congress this morning, having to do with the seating of the electors in the presidential race, with Dave Weigel, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Robert in Atlanta, you're on WNYC. Hi, Robert. Thank you for calling in.
Hey, thank you for having me. I'm a seventh generation Atlanta Georgian, and I'm proud of the fact that Georgia has done this. And I just hope the country can honor those, even those people that voted for Trump, because they've been dissatisfied for some reason. And I think Warnock summed it up beautifully when he said that this is the country only in America, similar to Mr. Obama, President Obama's statement, that in this country where his mother, who is now 82, picked cotton for someone else, a white man most likely, was able to vote for her youngest son to be United States Senator. I was writing a friend of mine that lives in D.C., and as I was writing that, the goosebumps came up on my arms. After especially this autocrat has been in office, I can still feel goosebumps at that notion.
Mm-hmm.
That, oh my God.
That's good. Go ahead.
Can live okay. for a way that we can bring people together, and hopefully this is the beginning of that, and somebody can come up. I pray for a man like a king or someone with the ability to have rhetoric to keep that message in front of us, that this is a place, one of the only places in the world that can try to include people that aren't included. Thank you for inviting me to your program.
Robert, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your emotion. And Dave Weigel, have you been hearing that kind of emotion in your Georgia reporting?
Yes. I went to D.C. for the other thing we're talking about today, based before the race was called. So I haven't been in Georgia getting people's reactions there, but I was getting it on the trail. And I was talking before about why Warnock's personal appeal and why the sense that he was being really done unfairly by these negative ads, why that helped motivate voters. So you would see that when you'd see people hear from Warnock. He was a fairly powerful orator. I mean, he was a little more careful in his single debate with Loeffler. But you did see that emotional connection to him, and I think that is a reason why Ossoff is favored. He's ahead. But there were two factors there. I think one that Loeffler was just viewed much more negatively than Purdue. Purdue had a reputation. Now he'd only been a one term, but reputation is more of a outsider businessman who kind of earned his way into the Senate as opposed to being appointed, and was just both less alienating to people than Loeffler. And Ossoff's story was not as inspiring as Warnock's, and that explains a little bit of the discrepancy, but it's really not much. I mean, I think they're going to end up running maybe 30,000 votes apart in a race with 4.7 million votes, maybe a bit less.
Right, or 50.6% for Warnock in his victory compared to 50.2%. So overwhelmingly, people voted for both Democrats or for both Republicans. But it could wind up that Warnock won and Ossoff lost, even though Ossoff is leading. So you just gave us some of the basis on which that slim difference might have occurred. What about misogyny? We don't talk about it much when it comes to Republican women, but, you know, there are hurdles to being a black candidate, as Warnock was. There are hurdles to being a woman candidate, as Kelly Loeffler was.
Right, and while there's a lot of focus on the history of Raphael Warnock becoming the state's first black senator, the state has now not ever elected a female senator. She was appointed. The previous female senator from Georgia, who was only served for, I think, a day or a couple of days, just in a vacancy that was being filled, also appointed. Add to that the first person that John Ossoff ran against, the casualties of the last few years was Karen Handel, who was a female Republican politician who came very close to winning a primary for governor, ran for Senate. So I think that bit around the edges, but Loeffler's, her approach to the race and her branding as this kind of rootin' tootin' conservative whose ads, remember, I'm saying, remember, maybe not everyone watches these ads as obsessively as I do, but she was running ads in the final days of the primary, calling her more conservative than Attila the Hun. So she was not leaning in on any of the qualities that I think some of the more successful female Republican politicians, which includes a lot of winners in the House races this year. I think the majority of House Democrats who lost re-election lost to female candidates, who lost to female Republicans. There wasn't much of a misogyny backlash in those races. And in fact, but Republicans emphasized that. And that's why I was saying this earlier. There was some hope in January 2020 when Loeffler was appointed she might run a race like that instead of the race she ran. I think running as this hard right candidate who is mostly speaking negative things about her opponent as opposed to talking about her own agenda, I think that's a bigger factor than any misogyny.
Ellen in Stamford, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ellen. Thank you for calling in. Ellen, are you there? Ellen in Stamford, once. Ellen in Stamford, twice. Ari in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ari. Maybe we're having a phone spot.
Hey, this is Ari in Brooklyn. Thanks for taking my call. I was hoping you could talk a little bit about the role of progressive organizations on the ground in Georgia and how they work to really provide some of the margin. So groups like the New Georgia Project or national groups like Mi Gente or Surge, you know, groups that really have, you know, plenty of policy differences with Ossoff and Warnock from the left, but who nonetheless, you know, I think really delivered this margin and, you know, worked on the doors and made, you know, millions of phone calls and how that maybe, you know, not only is the reason we're having this conversation this morning, but also what that means for sort of the will that give sort of the Democratic establishment any pause, you know, as they have really quite a history of punching left, you know, when they win or when they lose, you know, and so is this sort of a day we can say, oh, look, actually the left wing of the Democratic Party, whatever you think about us politically, strategically, we're essential, you know, and strategically, you know, black women, immigrants, queers, that's the reason why Warnock and Ossoff are going to the Senate.
Dave.
I think he makes a good point. The expression is, victory has 1,000 fathers and defeat's an orphan. And there felt like there were about 1,000 groups that poured into Georgia on behalf of the Democrats to help out with this. He mentioned a couple. I went out canvassing with a New South PAC, and I noted in one of my articles that the some of the doors that this new South PAC canvassers were going to, Black PAC had just been there. There's another group that was founded a few years ago to target Black voters with a more substantive kind of policy messaging about what could be done if Democrats win, as opposed to just, you know, coming back and asking them to vote because they're Democrats. The Working Families Party, the Sunrise Movement, if you can think of a liberal group, it probably got involved in Georgia. And Republicans did the same. They brought in some groups, but it was far less effective. It was they had a lot of rallies that didn't seem to do a whole lot. A lot of special guests who came in. But no, there's very effective progressive organizing. But to his point that Democrats tend to punch left if they win or they lose, it's not complicated in Georgia, but it's worth noting what happened. Ossoff and Warnock did not run as left-wing candidates. Actually, when Ossoff was running for the House in 2017, Bernie Sanders pointedly said, you know, he wasn't sure if Ossoff was a progressive. Actually, I think I might have been the first person who asked him about that, because he was campaigning around the country with Tom Perez, and he didn't get involved in that race. And Warnock, too. I mean, he was very pointed whenever being accused of wanting to defund the police or do something radical, said he didn't want to. And Ossoff also started the runoff, actually, with this interview with Axios, where he almost, they were kind of going over the bullet point liberal issues, because those were very big in people's minds right after Trump lost the election, but did it better than expected. And he was very happy to do so. He ran through. He said he wasn't for court packing. The jury was out on the filibuster. He was against defunding the police. He was against getting rid of private health insurance. And I think this does matter. Now, one thing that the Trump campaign wasted a lot of time on with Joe Biden is just accusing him of holding positions no one believes he holds. And John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock were not as well known when this campaign began as Joe Biden. So usually campaigns have a chance to brand a candidate you've never heard of. You know, the introduction they'll make is here's some radical beliefs they don't believe. But Democrats had enough money to contradict that, and they did not run as progressives in the style of Bernie Sanders. They ran as kind of Joe Biden Democrats, but Joe Biden ran a more liberal campaign than Hillary Clinton did 4 years ago, or frankly, that Barack Obama did in 2008, just because of the way politics had moved. So, yes, they relied on a lot of this progressive organizing to turn votes out, which was very effective. But they also massaged the messaging. So I don't think anyone can go look at this race and say this is a mandate for the entire Bernie Sanders agenda, but they can look at it and say, look, the consultants who were telling everybody that we're going to lose if Democrats and Republicans use the magic words to fund the police, they need to calm down. There's actually a way to work around these issues and come up with something positive.
And I think, based on seniority, Bernie Sanders stands to be the chairman of the Budget Committee if Ossoff also wins his race, so that ought to be interesting. What do you make of the impact
that was
of...
Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, that was a talking point for the Republicans.
It was a talking point for Republicans to their voters, that if we lose this, Bernie Sanders is going to run the Budget Committee. And I point that out because a lot of their talking points were a little bit misleading. That one's not wrong. I mean, Democrats will have the ability to confirm judges pretty easily. If they want to raise taxes, they can do that without a filibuster. And, the committee chairmanships, you're going to have Bernie Sanders running the Budget Committee if this all holds. So that was true.
And we won't get to hear Mitch McConnell talk like this very much anymore.
What do you make of the impact of Trump in this race, including his insertion of the $2,000 stimulus checks issue at the last minute, which the Democrats had endorsed, but the Republicans then had a scramble to change their positions on to line up with him? And also his rally Monday night was much more focused on the false claims that he won his election rather than on the senators.
He had a disastrous impact on these campaigns. I think Republicans, with him on the way out, are happier to throw him under the bus. It's just he can't really shake it. Like, the final political rally of his career as president this term was sending off two people who lost the re-election. So on paper, starting there, it didn't go very well. But he had a really dilatory impact on these campaigns again and again. So I remember I was in the state the first week of the runoff. Republicans started to bring in surrogates and bring in resources. And I talked to Rick Scott, who's going to be the chairman of the Senate Republican Campaign Committee, the NRSC. And one of the questions, natural question to ask on November 13th or 14th, was, do you think that these the president telling people that he still could win, is that going to complicate this race? Because if the president was winning, if he'd won the election and Democrats won these races, well, Republicans would still control the Senate because Joe Biden won. Kamala Harris will break the tie. Everyone knows those rules now, but I was laying out to Scott, and he said, well, the election is on January 5th, and the presidential race will be over by then. And you could let that hang in the air. I mean, the Republicans were optimistically saying, we're going to indulge the president for a while, but surely he will stop doing this by the time people are voting. And he didn't. So you mentioned the checks. I would add to that, the Republicans called for the resignation of the Secretary of State without saying anything that he'd done wrong. They just were siding with Trump on that. That was divisive, and that backfired on them.
The Georgia Secretary of State, Republican, Raffensperger. So what happens now in that respect? Yeah. One, are the races close enough that there will be recounts delaying a final call? Because there may be a lot of Democratic triumphalism around this morning, but these races are not official yet. And are there any attempts emerging to discredit these elections as fraudulent, as, of course, Trump is doing with the presidential race in Georgia?
Yeah, well, I think I was saying before that because we saw how Biden won the state, it's not even worth being hypothetical. Republicans don't expect those final votes to break their way. So Ossoff is going to end up with more votes, with a bigger margin, I should say, than Biden. Warnock already is there. I mean, his margin is about five times as big as Biden's. The Warnock race is not going to be, you can't recount it. There's just on the books, you cannot ask for the race to be recounted if it was a 1 point margin. It needs to be under 0.5%. So Ossoff's knocking on the door there, and there's a chance that Republicans demand that Perdue demands a recount, and that Senate Republicans, who would have 50 seats in the Senate to 49 for Democrats until that race is resolved, that they say they're not, you know, they're going to wait for the recount to settle this. But the timing of this is that the votes are being counted pretty quickly. We'll have the military ballots by Friday. The race is probably able to be certifiable. You can probably certify this race by the weekend or by next week. A recount would be requested, but without getting into all the timeline details, we're not talking about a ton of time. And unless there is some discrepancy, if there is no recount process if Ossoff is above 0.5%, and a lot of what Republicans have been doing to delay this, to demand things not be certified, that state legislators uncertify elections, that's just not feasible. Now, I'm not saying that there's not going to be a state legislator who tries, or the president doesn't demand it be done, or Marjorie Taylor Greene, who frankly is a reason that the Democrats won, because in her district she did nothing to turn out votes, and turnout was fairly low in a Republican area. High, but for this runoff, pretty low. They don't really have any tools in the toolbox that Trump hasn't used that were unsuccessful in reversing a much closer race. So I think if Ossoff ends up with a lead of 0.5% plus anything, probably the race is over, apart from some shouting and some protests. They probably would not be seated during the Trump presidency. They probably would be seated maybe the first few days of the Biden-Harris presidency.
Right. You meant to say certified before. You accidentally said certifiable and laughed it off. More people are seriously talking about whether the president is certifiable at this point with the things he's trying to pull. But one more call. Robin in Alpharetta, Georgia, in the Atlanta area. You're on WNYC. Hi, Robin.
Hey, Brian. We talked like a week and a half ago, I think, before the election.
I remember you.
And
call.
I was just, Oh, thank you. So I just worked 5 days in a row at my hospital. We had another record-setting day for COVID cases. Most of our hospitals are on diversion. We can't accept patients. That's how bad it is.
Bringing us
and
back to
reality.
And I had
reality. a really grueling, horrible day. But last night, for the first time in a really long time, I went to bed with hope. And I woke up to these numbers, and it's going to mean, and I think that's what Georgia voters voted for, is relief. I mean, the House has done the work, and now the Senate can do the work. And talk about, you know, tiebreaker, Senator, you know, now VP-elect Harris. I mean, it's going to be a real game changer, not only for the United States, but definitely for the people of Georgia. And I think that's what we voted for, and I'm so, so glad.
Robin, thank you for calling us again from Alpharetta. And again, we have to say that these are not final results, but they do seem to be trending in that direction. Dave Weigel, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Before you go, let's just make this segue very briefly. As you did in your reporting, you've been covering Georgia, and now you're in D.C. to cover this drama in Congress today. And I'm not going to go over for the umpteenth time on this show what the Republicans get to do to object in the House and the Senate and the floor debate that we're likely to see today, because we know how it's going to turn out. The electoral vote is going to be certified by a majority of the House and the Senate. But there is some drama around the role of Vice President Pence, whose job is supposed to be ceremonial, officially accepting the Electoral College results after Congress votes to defeat these challenges. But Trump, as you know, has been leaning on him heavily to declare a 10-day delay in pursuit of what they're calling an audit of selected states. I just want to play a clip of Al Gore in that same role in 2001, after he lost that heavily contested election to George W. Bush, when he stood up on the Senate floor playing the same role.
The whole number of the electors appointed to vote for President of the United States is 538, of which a majority is 270. George W. Bush of the state of Texas has received for President of the United States 271 votes. Al Gore of the state of Tennessee has received 266 votes. This announcement of the state of the vote by the President of the Senate shall be deemed a sufficient declaration of the persons elected President and Vice President of the United States, each for the term beginning on the 20th day of January 2001, and shall be entered, together with a list of the votes, on the journals of the Senate and the House of Representatives. May God bless our new President and our new Vice President, and may God bless the United States of America.
A little pro forma statement, dry as toast, but goosebumps, right, folks, in hearing it right at this moment. So are we going to hear something like that from Mike Pence today, Dave?
By the end of the process, I would expect that. Thank you for the warning. People don't need the schoolhouse rock lesson for the umpteenth time. But Republicans have already been kind of tailoring their ambitions. There are reports they're going to, even though there are seven states where Republicans tried to say we have alternate electors. Well, first, there's only five that bothered sending those electors to the archives. And because they didn't really have any legal authority, the archives of the United States only gave the electors that Biden won for debates. And the rules of this process don't let Pence do that. Now, so I think the president has basically rerun the playbook that he ran around this wait until we get to the Supreme Court hoax a couple weeks ago, which is there's going to be something happening. There's the vice president's power to do it. It's a great buildup followed by it not succeeding, because the options here really are Pence doing his job or a constitutional crisis that would wind up very quickly in court. Until it happens, you can't say what the final result is. I mean, I'm frankly more comfortable saying Ossoff will win that election than someone predicting what Pence will actually say. Who knows if he thinks there's a compromise where he can make some statement that casts doubt in the election while confirming it. Because Republicans will refer to evidence that's going to be presented, and we've seen what the evidence is. And the president has made several videos and kind of wasted most of his speech in Georgia repeating facts that aren't true about the election. Let's take stock after the challenge to Arizona, where Republicans say a bunch of stuff that's not true and the votes are upheld for Joe Biden. And how much, because even this process, basically, there's going to be a loss there. There'd be a loss when they challenge Georgia. How much further are they willing to go? We shall see, but Republicans are in a far worse mood about this stuff than they were yesterday. And you saw the people who stuck their necks out first have been abandoned by already most Republican senators have taken a position on this. But yeah, the question of Pence, there is pressure on him to do something he can't do, just like there's pressure on John Roberts to do something he can't do, just like there was pressure on Brian Kemp to do something he can't do. The president says a lot, but his word isn't really worth anything at this point.
Dave Weigel, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. I have a feeling you did this on very little sleep today, and you gave us a lot of time, and you gave us a lot of great analysis. So we really, really appreciate it even more than usual.
I really appreciate talking about it. Thank you very much.